Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to this special edition of the Seneca Podcast, recording live from the Hong Kong International Literary Festival. The Seneca Podcast is produced in partnership with SupChina. Visit SupChina.com and subscribe to our Access newsletter for a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm joined, of course, by Jeremy Goldcorn, editor-in-chief of SupChina, and a man who's pretty sure he can still secure an appointment with the Trump administration with just a couple of more firing efforts. I mean, yeah, who knows? He'll be in office for just a couple of weeks, but that's good enough, right? Jeremy, speak to people, won't you? The revolving door will still be there.
Kaiser, you're still so confident that American democracy is going to hold up, you know?
Actually, I'm not. Well, we're thrilled to be talking to two old friends of ours from Beijing, Pallavi Iyer and Anand Krishnan, both of whom spent much of their professional lives reporting from Beijing and are some of the most astute observers of contemporary China who I know, and especially good when it comes to offering insightful comparisons to Asia's other colossus, its neighbor across the Himalayas.
The multi-talented Pallavi Iyer has written a lot on China. Smoke and Mirrors, her debut work published in 2008, is a fantastic book that combines reportage, memoir, and travelogue, and is liberally sprinkled with astute observations, often hysterically funny, about Beijing and China and her adventures in the space between India and China. Pallavi's also written a novel called Chinese Whiskers, which is about the adventures of two cats named Soybean and Tofu who live in a traditional courtyard house in 21st century Beijing. Her book Choked from 2016 is about air pollution and air pollution in Beijing and New Delhi, two of the world's most polluted cities, or they were at the time in any case. Now I believe it's actually San Francisco after a summer of wildfires, but it was very funny to see Californians checking the AQI every day for people who've lived in Delhi or Beijing. Anyway, along the way, Pallavi also wrote The Lonely Planet Guide, China for the Indian Traveler, and most recently she edited a volume of prose, poetry, and polemic called A Thousand Cranes for India.
Anand Krishnan has been on our program many times now, usually, alas, for some flare-up on the Sino-Indian border, which he's got to explain and walk through the whole damned history of the McMahon Line and the LAC and the 62 Sino-Indian War. But today we're going to spare him all of that. Anand was China Bureau Chief for the Hindu and Associate Editor for India Today in Beijing. He left China in 2018 after nearly a decade there. He was a Brookings India Fellow and is now back at the Hindu. His debut book is called India's China Challenge, A Journey Through China. His rise and what it means for India.
So today we're not going to be talking about the specifics of conflict in Ladakh or the Doklam Plateau, but instead we're going to talk about some of the big picture questions about popular understanding and misunderstanding going in both directions. So let's dive in. Anand, you've talked about both the curiosity about China in India and the lack of information about China that you encounter among your compatriots. What is the barrier? If your compatriots are curious, what stops them from being well informed on China?
Well, first of all, thank you, Kaiser, Jeremy, and great to see you, Pallavi. And thanks to everyone at the Hong Kong Literature Fest. I think all of us are pretty bummed that we couldn't be there in person. but it's great to be part of this event virtually. I think it's an interesting question, Jeremy. I think if I can use the media as one example, I think the fact that you and Kaiser are in conversation with, I just did a back of the envelope calculation that you are currently speaking with 20% of the entire Indian press corps that's served in Beijing in the last 20 years tells you that, how underinvested we've been in covering the country. I think that part of it is that I think the media in India is really domestic driven in so many ways. I mean, it is understandable in one sense because there's so many stories to cover in this country. But at the same time, I think there's been a history of really not paying attention. And I think it's inexcusable, especially when China is concerned, because I don't think there's a more important relationship, whether in a good way or a bad way. And I think this year has reminded us of that, both in terms of the pandemic and the boundary crisis as well. I think part of it is just how the media in India functions. I think in the last few years, even when it comes to domestic news, there's been a really worrying trend of opinion replacing reportage. People aren't sending reporters into the field, even in India. So I think it's not just a China problem. But I think in China, of course, the language is another barrier. I think Pallavi was really an exception in being a fluent Mandarin-speaking correspondent who was there at the time of the Olympics. And I think she would attest to the fact that Indian media organizations don't train their reporters in language before sending them out. It's something that you have to do on your own initiative and your own time. It really is a mindset problem, and it's something that I really lament in the book. And I'm not holding my breath for it to change, since I think it's a broader structural problem, not China specific, but it's something that really worries me, Jeremy.
Anant, staying with you for a second, your book actually talks about mutual ignorance. I know from experience that there's plenty of Chinese ignorance about India, but I would also venture to suggest that there's not much by way of curiosity about India either. How much do you fault the Chinese media for failing to address this ignorance?
No, for sure. But I think it's, as far as China is concerned, there is also, obviously, I think it's understandable that there's more curiosity in India because the relationship, I think China is more important to India than the other way around. That's a reality, as much as people in India wouldn't want to hear that. So I think it is natural that there's going to be a skew given the weight of China and the importance that it occupies in the world today. But from my own experience, in the last 10 years that I've been in China, I think that is beginning to change in some ways. I left feeling somewhat optimistic, especially because of young tech entrepreneurs. I think India is a really, really big market for them. It was until this year, at least, before India went out banning Chinese apps. So I left in 2018 coming away somewhat optimistic that younger Chinese people in the tech sector, more Chinese journalists were trying to move to India, even if they couldn't get visas. So I think it is beginning to change in China, although in pretty small steps.
Pallavi, you've done your share of vox pops in your time as a reporter in China, asking ordinary people about their impressions of India. Can you give us a sense of the range of responses you tended to get? And perhaps I could ask you to include some of the more memorable, if not representative, responses that you've gotten over the years.
Yes, well, vox pops was really one stock in trade. And I spent about 7 or 8 years in Beijing reporting. And every time we'd have a high level visit, either from the Indian side coming to China or vice versa, I'd be sent off with a little mic to sort of wander around some of the neighborhoods in Beijing and ask them, you know, what do you think of India? First thing that comes to your mind. And most of the answers ran along pretty standard lines. I would get Buddhism a lot, and it's a Buddhist country, and of course Buddhism had died out in India more than 1,000 years ago. I would get a lot of Hindi films, song singing, because particularly amongst a particular demographic, Hindi movies had been amongst the first foreign films that were allowed to be shown publicly in China. So through the 70s and 80s, a certain vintage of movies from Bollywood, which in India had been shot in the 50s and 60s and had very strong socialist themes, in which, you know, rich girl falls in love with poor boy and it all sort of ends in doom. But there was this kind of sense of inequality and socialism in these movies, which was deemed acceptable, and these became hugely popular. And the result was that many people knew the lyrics by heart, and I had tons of footage of people bursting into song and dance, as good as any Bollywood actor or actress in the streets of Beijing, and rehashing these old songs that had more or less disappeared from the imagination back in India. I got some very blunt responses: India, poor country, or oh, you don't have a one-child policy, that's really bad. I heard things about rat temples and all kinds of exoticism, you know, so far so standard. But I remember thinking that something had perhaps changed when in 2006, I think it was, when Hu Jintao was going to India, I was wandering around the hutong that I lived in, and I came across this old bicycle repairman called Lao Yang. And I asked him, you know, Lao Yang, can you tell me what you think about when you think about India? And he was very reluctant to answer and was like, no, I don't know anything about India. I don't want to be on television. And I was like, no, come on, you know, it really doesn't matter. We don't need any kind of punditry. Just what's the first thing that you think about? And he kept refusing, and I finally sort of managed to badger him enough to agree. And he turned around and said, well, I really know very little, but I do know that the telecom policy in India is very advanced. And, you know, in China, we have a duopoly. But in India, you have all this free choice when it comes to choosing your mobile phone network. And this is something that China should really learn from India. And I was blown away by this, because I'd been expecting the Buddhism, the rats, the poverty, you know, all the sort of usual tropes. And suddenly here, I got this informed kind of soliloquy on the telecom policy. And, you know, it was indicative at some level of how things were shifting. And you were getting reports in the Chinese media on a slightly broader range of topics as well. And the whole sort of new economy and India rising as an IT power and things was something that was gradually beginning to be acknowledged in China. So, I mean, there's still, I would say this was a minority view, and the majority view continued to be largely negative, you know, either ignoring India altogether or sort of largely negative, flaring up when there were flashpoints along the border and so on. But there was a slight broadening.
That the whole confusion over Buddhism and Hinduism is just so bizarre to me. It's something I've encountered so frequently. Anyway, if I think anyone who spends a bit of time in China knows how fond Chinese people are, not just the elites, but even ordinary people, as your Vox Pops sort of sample size shows, but of using India as a sort of foil. Sure, India is a democracy, but, you know, look what a mess it is. Look at the state of the infrastructure. All those people on top of the trains. It's always the trains. But anyone, you know, of course, anyone who, as you say, wants to defend the one-child policy always cites India. It's the go-to case for why democracy supposedly would never work.
Absolutely. Right? So Russia and India.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Russia post-91, right, and then India. A couple of questions, though. What are some of the usual ways in which Indian people respond to that common critique coming from China? And what do Chinese people, I'm sorry, what do Indian people make of Chinese authoritarianism? Because I've come across Indians who are unapologetically admiring of it and want that kind of technocratic authoritarian rule. I've also come across Indians, many more of them, I should say, who have a very exaggerated idea of the extent of Chinese political control in everyday life. So maybe give us your sense, Pallavi, you first, and then Anath, back to you.
I've always said that, you know, in India, the reactions to China tend to swing between pride and prejudice, but based on very little information. I've been something that Anand pointed out right at the beginning. In terms of actual knowledge about China, there's a huge lacuna. I hadn't jumped in on the very first question, but just to point out that when I moved to Beijing in 2002, I was one of only two journalists that was covering this whole rise of China at a point when the combined populations of the two countries was, you know, about a third of the world's population. And we didn't have any direct flights even at the time that linked India and China. It was absolutely absurd. The only way to get from Beijing to Delhi was on an Ethiopian Airways flight that used to go from Delhi to Addis Ababa and stop over, from Beijing to Addis Ababa and stop over in Delhi. So, you know, there's this ridiculous lack of actual real information, but there is an obsession and a great amount of interest in it. So it creates creates a kind of contradiction where everybody is obsessed with China but actually knows very little about it. On the Pride and Prejudice, I mean, on the one hand, I think you've got, you know, middle class Indians that are just drooling at the idea of India transforming itself into China. And China has very much become the benchmark because it's also quite accessible. So when they think about what their idea of an ideal city would be, what they would want cities like Delhi and Mumbai to be transformed into, what they're looking at is Shanghai, you know, because it's something that's so modern and glittering and feeds into all their fantasies of sort of beggar-free, pothole-free cities. But at the same time, it's something that's relatively close. I mean, if China can do it, we can do it. It's not like saying, let's transform Mumbai into New York or into London. Certainly amongst the business classes and industrialists, there is a kind of envy of the lack of problems supposedly that exist in China with disciplining labor. And some very unsavory sentiments I've come across, including, you know, oh, if only India could be like China, because, you know, people, these labor, they only really understand the stick, the danda. What they really want is someone to kind of beat them and, you know, then all our problems would be solved. But then on the other hand, it also becomes an excuse, because when you show that India is underperforming in a whole range of different areas, it's like, oh, but, you know, we are free and we are democratic and therefore we cannot be expected to really match China, and it's comparing apples to oranges. So it also kind of ends up giving a free pass for poor governance, which I think is quite interesting, because we often tend to kind of associate democracies with good governance, that because people will be more responsive to the needs of people. But in India, I think you often end up having a counterintuitive state of affairs where the democracy, because it focuses so much on process, the legitimacy of these governments comes from the very fact of their having been elected rather than them fulfilling their promises or delivering good governance and public goods. So we end up with a very counterintuitive situation where China's authoritarian government, where the legitimacy to the government actually comes from delivering growth and delivering various other goals, can sometimes be more responsive than a democracy like India.
Anand, instead of tackling the same question, let me ask you this. India's political authority, Modi, the BJP, derives from a widely recognized democratic process. It has electoral legitimacy. Some say that China's, on the other hand, the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, their legitimacy derives from actually getting things done, that China's leadership has performance legitimacy. And they often... often use this argument. I mean, there's one of the more trollish of the Chinese state media journalists, whenever China gets criticized on Twitter, often replies with a simple tweet saying, high-speed trains, which kind of sums things up. How does this idea, can you talk about the idea of performance legitimacy in India, Anand?
I can guess. But I think it's interesting that I think that notions of legitimacy are changing, I think, all over the world. I think that in China too. I mean, I would question the conventional wisdom and the premise that we all still hold on to, that it's only because the Communist Party delivers high GDP growth rates that they enjoy legitimacy. I think those things are changing. I think there's other aspects coming into it in terms of nationalism in both countries, the way people look at who is their best sort of representative of their values. And I think that in India as well, I think Prime Minister Modi is a good example for the fact that he was elected easily in 2019 after presiding over 5 years of a disastrous economic tenure, which included self-inflicted goals, own goals, like this demonetization of currency notes that happened overnight. And then again, if you come to 2020 and the way India has handled COVID-19, the fact that you had a lockdown that was announced with just a 4-hour window, and you had tens of thousands of people who had to walk thousands of kilometers home, some of whom who died on the way. Every opinion poll that I've seen shows that he's been completely, his approval ratings are as high as they were. The election results that we had 2 days ago in Bihar strongly point to the fact that he remains extraordinarily popular. So I think it is quite interesting. I feel notions of legitimacy are changing everywhere around the world, where it's not just, I think it's a complicated question and I'm not the most qualified to answer it, but I think the way people vote, even in where both of you are, Jeremy and Kaiser, it leads you to sort of ponder that it's complicated how people look at how their interests are best represented. I don't think it comes down to one thing. And I think even in China, it's something I mentioned in the book where I speak to a lot of people, Chinese intellectuals, who look at why Xi Jinping has been governing the way he has been as reflecting a sense that it was inevitable that he has to turn to nationalism in some way, shape or form to create a kind of ideological tether to the people. And I think and that is reflecting in a lot of China's actions in the last few years. And I think it's not exclusive to China alone. You see that in India as well. You see that in much of the world. So I think it's fluid and it's changing. And I think it's much more complex than I think the kind of assumptions that we have, especially as far as China is concerned, that if GDP falls below X, there's going to be unrest and the party's in trouble. I think it's more complicated than that.
Nationalism is something I want to get to in a little bit. I have a couple of questions specifically about that, you know, looking at Chinese and Indian nationalisms. But Pallavi, first I want to ask you, I remember when we spoke some years back, after your first book came out, actually, I guess it was more than a decade ago, you had a kind of litmus test when thinking about China and India. And that was the question, would you rather be born in China or in India? I mean, you complicated a bit, but can you talk about how you answered that back then and maybe what your answer would be today, 7 or 8 years or, you know, decades or so later, whether that's changed at all?
So I think, my answer has not changed in the sense that what I said in the book, and I still hold by that now, is that your answer to whether I would rather be born Indian or Chinese, that's how I phrased it in the book, would very much depend on where I were located on the sort of socioeconomic scale of things. And I remember sort of looking at by different case studies, saying, for example, were I a sanitation worker, somebody who was cleaning toilets, I think I would probably choose to be Chinese, because I think I would ultimately have a better chance of being literate, of being clothed, of being fed, and most importantly, a better chance of upward social mobility. On the other hand, if I were middle class and I, in India, for example, could provide the private means, I had the private means to circumvent the failure of public goods. So, for example, I don't get municipal water, but I can dig my own private tube well in the garden, or I don't really rely on the police to protect me, but I can have my own security guards, which is what a lot of middle class, upper middle class Indians do. I think my answer would be different. So, in that case, I think I might choose to be Indian, because India would afford me a lot of freedoms that I would not have in China. But I also think that it's possible to turn that on its head, because it's also possible to say that if you are poor, what you don't have much, but you at least have the vote, and the vote can be powerful. And in India, it's been shown that the vote is actually appreciated the most by poor people, in that when you look at demographics of who votes, it's overwhelmingly the poor who vote. Because in some ways, you know, that's what they have. That's the power that they have to force the government to protect them in some way. You can't have these kind of slum clearance projects that you do in China. You can't just, you know, overnight have people move away. The fact that in India, you know, you've had all these land acquisition deals that have been held up by very poor people often, and they do have that power to that they hold over, say, even big industrialists. So it's very hard really to come up with very definitive answers on this. But I think what living in China taught me is really that in some ways ideology is worthless, and it's very difficult to have a priori answers to these questions, and that the lived experience counts much more, and this differs from individual to individual and circumstance to circumstance.
Sure.
So I think on average, probably a Chinese is better off in terms of the standards of living and also on the human development index. And this is something to keep in mind. So if you're looking at nutrition, maternal mortality, female literacy, all of those things, you know, you're probably better off in China. But as a journalist and an intellectual and a liberal, I feel like I'm better off as an Indian. That's a tough one to answer in a definitive way.
Although I think I would answer it just as you did. Anant, what about you? I think you would answer it a bit differently.
I would. I mean, it's a great question that I first read in one of Pallavi's writings before I moved to China. And it's a question that stayed with me because I think it's a really good question to ask. And I like that because it made me think through so many things about living in China these last few years. And I really liked what Pallavi just said, the one line she said where it depends on your lived experience. And thinking through that question for me, I found so many exceptions on both ends of the spectrum that I found quite fascinating. And I think the other point that I would just add to what Pallavi said is that the one thing that I really took away, I think, from China was the fact that within China, the disparities, the regional differences are so incredible. And that applies to India too, that in some ways, for me, looking at both countries at a national level, at a 40,000 feet level, in many ways doesn't really capture, I think, the lived experience. And I think that Pallavi is absolutely right. There's no question if you look at standard of living, how China has eliminated poverty. If you're at the lowest end of the economic ladder, no question that you wouldn't have the struggles in China that so many people in India have. But I think that if you bring in issues of identity, it gets a little more complicated, as well as the regional disparities. For example, the easy example to think of is if you're a poor Muslim, if you were in a southern Indian state or Kerala, where I live in Tamil Nadu, vis-a-vis Xinjiang, I think it would be a no-brainer for many people. And right. I think at the other end of the spectrum as well, I would agree with Pallavi that as an Indian, if I was moderately well off, I think you would say India because you cherish these institutions that we're used to, whether it's a free press or whether it's a judiciary. So I would think that I'd say a moderately well-off Indian would choose India, but a moderately well-off Chinese would choose China because they would emphasize different values. And I don't think they would look at India as a place where they would like to move. But what I would say where they would both agree on is a moderately well-off Indian and Chinese, if you gave them the choice, they'd probably choose the US or the UK, is what I would say.
that would probably applies to quite a lot of the world. Let's talk about the status of women in both countries. Pallavi, back to you. Both countries have had their share of bad press about the status and treatment of women. We don't need to go through the details. They're kind of different. But both countries can also hold up examples of women who made it. Two heads of state in India's case, and in China's quite a number of billionaires, even though women are appallingly underrepresented in government. But maybe we can use the same question about where you'd rather be born. Which country would you rather be born in as a woman?
Anant doesn't get to answer this one, though. Only.
Why not? These days, gender is very fluid. No, but I was talking about. I think the one thing that really struck me when I moved to China was how I found them very empowered. And this was coming from a situation when everything I had read about China before moving to China would have led me to think the opposite, because I was very used to hearing about the kind of foot binding and the deep patriarchy in China and so on. But I think the thing that struck me the most was just the physical difference in how women in Chinese cities occupied space compared to women in India and Indian cities. And, I was so used to, like, for example, in Delhi or whatever, just when you're walking on the streets, ending up sort of looking down a lot of the time because you don't want to make eye contact with people, because it's almost like you will invite what we very quaintly in India call eve teasing, which essentially means people whistling, passing comments, but it gets worse. It can end up with groping and things like that as well. And, just the fact that Chinese women were sort of unapologetic about the fact that there they were out in public, and they expanded and they wore the clothes they wanted to wear. And you could see just in the body language a kind of confidence that you do not see in India. That made me wonder about all of these, comparisons and the fact that I'd heard about how oppressed and depressed Chinese women were. And just seeing the kinds of jobs that they did, of the fact that, you had women taxi drivers. I encountered women bus drivers, women conductors. I traveled across China as a journalist without once being questioned about, my being a woman or what I was doing over there. And the only time I really came across anything to the contrary was when I was interviewing an Indian businessman in Beijing, who kept asking me what I was doing in China. And I kept saying that I work here, I'm a journalist. And he kept saying, but what are you really doing here? And I kept saying, well, I'm a journalist, I'm here, I work for the Hindu. And this conversation went on. And then finally, I realized that I think he just didn't understand what I was doing in terms of the fact of my personal life. Like, so I basically said to him, well, my husband is here. At which point he was like, oh, you're here with your family, to aisa kahiye na, which translates as, so why didn't you say that? It suddenly, I kind of made sense to him. Whereas until then, it didn't make sense to him that, you know, I was out here on my own. So, I mean, you know, there were very obvious differences in that sense. And then this was also backed up, of course, by the data. I mean, if you looked at the participation of Chinese women in the labor force, it was higher than the global average. Whereas in India, it was much below the global average. I think today in India, it's something like 29% of women work, and as opposed to about 60% of women. It's been going down in both countries, interestingly, but there's still a huge gulf. What else? Literacy, female literacy at the time that I was in China. Again, female literacy in India has improved since then. But at the time, less than 50% of Indian women were literate. And I think something like 98% of Chinese women were literate. And so that led lends itself to an amazing kind of empowerment. I mean, the most insidious damage that you can do to a human being is deprive them of an education, because it kind of robs you of your own sense of self-worth, you know, which I think is also linked into just that occupying physical spaces that I was talking about, how confident you are in your own place as a human being, as part of civil society, being out there. And, you know, it was driven home at so many levels. I used to represent the Confederation of Indian Industry in Beijing as well. And I remember we had these delegations that would come from India, and they would bring gifts to give to the people that they would be meeting. And CII, as the organization would call, was always sending gifts of ties. And then we would meet with women, and they were like, oh my God. And I remember emergency phone calls back saying, we need something else. We can't just have ties. But these were just like the kind of underlying, you know, assumptions that you often came across. None of which is to say that, you know, you did not have patriarchy and you did not have male preference in China, and you did have a very skewed gender ratio as well. But I do think that some of this harks back to the communist revolution, and that some of its teachings broke down the worst amongst the discriminations. I mean, Mao famously declared that women hold up half the sky, and under his regime, women were given the right to divorce, to own land, etc., etc. And I think most importantly, for the first time, people were educated into a formal belief regarding gender equality. So, I mean, of course, it's debatable how much the lives of women actually improved under the kind of authoritarian, arguably megalomaniacal state project that Mao oversaw. And obviously the Communist Party's boosting of female labor force participation was a utilitarian endeavor that was aimed at increasing national productivity rather than expanding women's choices. And, you know, today women's choices very coercive. And today, women's choices also remain depressed in China. But I do think that, you know, people were educated into this formal belief regarding gender equality. And like in like in other aspects, the fact that China had a revolution meant that it broke more strongly with its kind of feudal patriarchal past than India did. And yeah, I think some of what we see in gender is very evident.
I'm so reminded right now of a book that I read last year by Peter Hessler, his new book on the Egyptian, on the Arab Spring experience, and how he talks about really the incompleteness of the Egyptian revolution, the lack of a revolution, and is constantly, you know, talking about China as sort of the foil there. And it really resonates with what you've just said. Earlier, you talked about social mobility, upward social mobility, and how you would sort of chalk that up in China's column as being better. We inevitably have to talk about caste. It's a sensitive topic, obviously, when it comes to any discussion about India. It also comes up a lot when making comparisons to China, with a lot of people arguing that China might not have a formal caste system, but there's certainly a lot of classism, a lot of regionalism, colorism in China as well. And others arguing that China's lack of a caste system, not an explicit, pronounced one anyway, is one of China's big advantages over India. Ananth, Pallavi, what are your thoughts on this?
Sure, yeah. I think I would add to some of the vox pops that Pallavi mentioned early on. The one that I always that struck with me was that, you know, when you're from India, the first thing I would hear is, you know, India is a big country. And then the second thing I would hear is, India has forecasts, in a way that they were kind of telling me that, that you know, you have. And then there would come the question, which one are you? So I think that that's one thing that a lot of people in China associate India with. And I would, I mean, I think that that really struck me as well. I think one takeaway that I had and I kept thinking about as well during my time in China is how much of a barrier it still is in India in so many ways. And the fact that, and I would completely agree with what Pallavi said on social mobility. And for me, there's no question that this is the number one overbearing, huge reason why. Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's crystal clear. And I think the fact that China was able to break away from it, it's, again, it's an uncomfortable thing because a lot of it, I suppose, happened in the 60s. And it came at a huge cost, to people as well. But I think one consequence of that, I don't know what Pallavi would think, but I mean, I think it's a fact that one consequence of that turbulence and of trying to shatter old ideas of society, was that, when China opened up in the 80s and 90s, you didn't have this whole barrier holding them back that we are still dealing with in a very painful way. And in India, we have so much, I mean, so far to go, even if legally, we have legally done what we have to do. The fact is, it's so ingrained in society. I mean, the easiest barometer of that is just go through the marriage advertisements in any Indian newspaper today, and you'll see it everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, still explicitly, even though...
Very explicit.
I mean,
okay. Like, wow. They will ask for people of a particular caste. I think it's most explicit in the marriage, in the area of marriage. You won't find that in, for example, at least explicitly in you know, for employment criteria, for example. They will I mean, never, as far as I know, list caste as a requirement. But for marriage, it's very common.
And there are no legal impediments to that?
For marriage, no, because it's a personal choice. You can choose that you want to marry anybody, you know, a tall person, a short person, a person from this caste, a person from that community, this religion. Yeah.
And there's no sort of opprobrium. I mean, like if you were to do that in the U.S., if you were to explicitly say, I only want to marry somebody from a sort of a WASPy upper, you know, Harvard graduate, or I think you would get called out at least
on social
media. No
problem at all. In fact, it's very much the opposite. If you have intercaste marriages are the one that often draw opprobrium. But if I might jump in over here, you know,
yeah.
I think one thing that really struck me, Kaiser, when I lived in China was how, when you looked at lowly jobs, they were very much sort of adjectives rather than nouns, as descriptions of their jobs rather than the essence of who they were. For example, if you were a toilet cleaner, that just meant you cleaned toilets. It was just describing what you did. It was an adjective. It was not, I am a toilet cleaner, as in that is my essence. That's what I've been born into. It's a very big difference. And I again think, you know, back to the communist revolution, that everyone of a certain generation had done physical labor and, you know, hauled shit and done all of that. And I think all the new richest parents had sort of scrubbed and cleaned as much as my IE did. And there was an awareness as a result of that there was a somewhat thin line separating you from another person who's doing another kind of job. And I think, you know, in India, this line of between purity and pollution, between certain kinds of jobs and certain other kinds of jobs or statuses and castes was almost sacred. And it was so rarely crossed as to make empathy across that line very difficult, make empathy across the lines of who was served, you know, those who were served and those who cleaned and those who had things cleaned and those who were served. Empathy across those lines, very difficult, was almost a very thick and sacred line. And I also think, you know, historically, China has been a more egalitarian society than India. The examinations to the Imperial Civil Services, for example, were theoretically open, theoretically at least, to anyone, and underpinned by the idea that merit rather than birth was the correct criterion by which to determine a person's future. So, you know, I think that had greater acceptability already in China. And I think one of the anecdotes that I always have, which has dropped jaws in India, is about my landlord, Mr. Wu. I call him Mr. Wu. I changed his name. I lived in an old courtyard house in a hutong in Beijing. And my landlord was apparently quite rich. He owned three or four of these courtyards. But whenever I had a plumbing problem, which was frequent given that the plumbing wasn't great in the Hutong neighborhoods. I would call him and he would come on this little motorbike thing that he had himself and insist on repairing the toilet because he didn't want to spend money calling a plumber. But the idea in India of you know, a landlord kind of going to people's homes to fix their toilets would have been really quite inconceivable. So something just as simple. But then Mr. Wu, you know, had spent 10 years in Inner Mongolia basically, you know, cleaning manure and carrying it around. So so he might have been rich now, but
Pallavi, if I may interrupt, isn't some of the sort of force of the caste system and this sort of quite specific classification of people connected to Hinduism, which leads me to another similar question, which is that I've heard in China quite a lot that what holds India back is religion. And I now live in Nashville, Tennessee, which is the buckle of the Bible Belt, where a lot of people don't believe in COVID-19 and seem to be held back by religion. So, but does this argument make any sense? Is there too much religion in India, and do religious beliefs hold back development?
You know, Jeremy, you're asking an atheist. You're asking an atheist, so I'm, you know, I can't claim a complete lack of bias in my answer over there.
Well, this is an atheist show, so feel
comfortable. But India is an overwhelmingly religious country. Overwhelmingly religious country. Okay, let me say this. I do think that, you know, religion does not necessarily have to be a terrible and regressive force. And I think particularly a religion like Hinduism, which in it has a sense of capaciousness and it has a possibility for plurality, which many other religions do not have. So, you know, Hinduism, I think if you really looked to its roots, would have the ability to be different from some of the other more monotheistic religions in accepting differences and in presenting diversity of thought, opinion, argumentation, all of that as fundamental to the religion itself. And therefore, I think India and a religious India has the capacity to be democratic and has the capacity to allow its wonderful diversity despite the existence of religion. But you also always with religions have the possibility of it being abused and the possibility of it being used as a tool of hatred and, you know, othering others. And we're seeing a brand of Hindu nationalism today, which I think is very antithetical to the actual roots of Hinduism, which would define itself in very narrow terms against diversity and kind of be a force towards homogenization, and certainly is not doing India any favors when it comes to its development. But at a larger point, I do think Indian society remains very religious. It did not have the communist revolution once again, and as a result, I think it has a much more there is a disjuncture between its constitution, which is a liberal constitution that was kind of grafted on emerging from this kind of European enlightenment as the result of British colonialism, and then the sort of morality, the social, the dominant social morality of average people in India, which is very religious, scriptural based and continues to not be liberal at all. And so you've kind of got a liberal constitution and an illiberal population. And we see a kind of constant tussle between these two, which explains, I think, a lot of the contradictions that you see in modern India today.
Pallavi, you've just explained many of the contradictions in modern India. It's just, what a fantastic answer. Speaking of religion, I mean, you know, so you were talking, of course, about the nationalistic credo of Hindutva. I want to talk about Chinese nationalism and Indian nationalism. We've been hearing a lot about the rise of Chinese nationalism for what now, I guess, 30 years from now. I am certainly no fan of nationalism in any form. I wonder, though, whether you would agree with me that Chinese nationalism, which doesn't have a religious core around which it can cohere, which doesn't have either a kind of specific ethnic or religious hatred, a kind of othering of people, and, you know, making of an enemy, it just maybe lacks the virulence of Hindutva, it's kept mainly online. I mean, we don't see a lot of Chinese nationalists, say, burning buses or attacking people on trains.
Well, you have the anti-Japanese you have the anti-Japanese sentiment, Kaiser, and you know Absolutely. That has been quite ugly sometimes, including burning things and boycotting things.
Sure, but that's, but yes, that's, but perhaps not, that's Anand outwardly would like to directed, come in here. Right. It's outwardly directed. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's, what, 170 million Muslims living in India, and you know, if you look at Modi's home state of Gujarat and what happened there. Anyway, my question.
The state takes care of that in China.
Right. The state does its own ethnic. It. Right. Exactly. Exactly. if they're in camps, we don't need. Right.
But I think Anand would be a great person to talk about the different types of nationalisms in the two countries. He's also been there during the rise, you know, during Xi Jinping's time.
Yeah, for sure. So Anand, let me turn to you for that.
Yeah. You know, I think that. Perhaps, I don't know, one thing that I would suggest, Kaiser, is probably just the different political systems. The fact that in India there's so many avenues for expression of these sentiments, which are limited in China. But more than that, I think the coming back to the caste and religion question, I think you asked the question if religion is holding India back. I'd say more than that, I'd say it's the politics that's holding India back, because the political system needs caste identities. It needs religious identities. It thrives on that. You'd be shocked if you watch any Indian news channel on election day, as I was unfortunately watching 2 days ago in Bihar. It's open that X party will field X candidate in a particular constituency just because of the caste arithmetic. It happens in every election, and it's open. And so political parties need to keep those identities alive and going. It's in their interest to do that. So I look at it as a political problem completely. Even with the Hinduism and the redefinition of Hinduism that's going on in India, as Pallavi said, I grew up familiar to a different kind of Hinduism, which she kind of encapsulated in terms of being liberal, in terms of having this plethora of gods, you choose which one that you liked for any reason. There was no official textbook. There is no official textbook. But there's been a move to change all of that, because having a religion that's so flexible is no good if it comes to mobilizing people. It doesn't serve a political use. So I think that it's the politics that's driving this sort of regressive interpretations of caste and religion in India more than anything else. And for me, that's what's terribly unfortunate. And in terms of comparing the two, I think they're quite similar in many ways. Even if you don't have the religious component, there is a kind of ethnic component, I would say. I think the fact that there are some similar strands that I find so striking when I'm in India, and some of the online reactions that you see in India remind me so much of what I would see in China as well, in terms of their similar disdain for example, journalists, especially if you're from the New York Times. I think you have an equal number of critics in India and in China. The idea that both countries are these unique civilizational states who've been oppressed by the rest of the world and they aren't given their due, the sense of resentment that's driving this impulse in both countries. So I see a lot of similarities, actually, which isn't a good thing, because when it comes to the relationship, it just makes things so much harder when you in dealing with so many of the legacy issues than it was even 15, 20 years ago. I think the window has passed, for India and China to resolve some of those issues. So it leaves me quite pessimistic in the way things are going, because it just becomes so much harder to deal with these things than it was in the past, when there's so much of sentiment now magnified by things like social media.
So if we can bring it back to the narcissistic country in which Kaiser and I live, the U.S. election saw the first woman, the first black person, and the first person of Indian heritage get elected to the vice presidency. The region of Tamil Nadu, where Kamala Harris's mother is originally from, has been celebrating her and claiming her as one of their own. Pallavi, you remarked to us when we were preparing for this conversation that the very same people celebrating Kamala Harris also decried Sonia Gandhi, who was not born to an Indian family but was naturalized as she was Italian. Can you explain this contradiction, or does it just defy explanation?
Yeah, this is, I'm not sure I can explain it. I'm not sure I can explain it, but I can elaborate on it. It's certainly, you know, one of these great Indian hypocrisies where we have a tendency to always claim Indians abroad as our own when they do great things. Yeah. So the moment an Indian becomes vice president of of the United States of America, you know, wins the Booker Prize, gets the Nobel Prize, suddenly it's like, rah, rah, Indian wins.
Sound familiar? Chinese do the same thing.
Indian becomes vice vice president Indian. You know, the Indian is kind of stretched, stressed up front and center. But, you know, for most people who leave India and go abroad, I mean, India wants nothing to do with them. For example, you know, we don't even allow dual citizenship. And the idea behind that is that once you live in another country, you've kind of left India, you've forsaken India, you've gone, go back to that country. Now, that's where your loyalties lie. So, you know, there's a great hypocrisy in this. Sonia Gandhi, like we mentioned earlier, will forever be foreign for the same brand of Indian who will cheer the fact that Kamala Harris became vice president in the United States. You see this in sports very often, you know, like if you have these cricket games, for example, if Indian Muslims, you know, cheer for any other team, Pakistan or any other team, then of course they're great traitors to the country. But when you've got Indians, British Indians, for example, sitting in London cheering for the Indian cricket team versus England, that's perfectly natural because after all, they are Indian. So, you know, there is this kind of contradiction, hypocrisy at the heart of many things. I guess it's also just part of human nature. I don't know that this multiplicity of identities is somehow suddenly welcome when you are abroad. You know, you can be American, but also Indian when you've done great things. But at home, there is a policing of those same identities to kind of fit within a narrow nationalistic ideal.
Let's talk about COVID-19 and how India has processed the whole pandemic, from China's early response to its later relative success in controlling the spread of the virus. I mean, what can you tell us about how India is talking about China and COVID-19? Anath?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to weigh in on this because I've been... So I was in Beijing in January when... So we went to Beijing on holiday, completely unaware of the fact that all of this was happening in Wuhan. So we were there literally 8 days before Zhong Nanshan went on TV and said, listen, it's, you know, it's a situation that's serious. So it was remarkable to see firsthand when I was there for the couple of weeks that I was there, the way the city kind of just shut down and got its act together. And then I flew to India. This was, I think, early February, right? Coming from the situation where we were masked up and so worried. And then I landed in Chennai airport and they just like waved me through. No one even bothered to check my temperature. I was like, can you please check my temperature and write it down? Because I didn't want to have an issue later. But then it seemed that no one was bothered until February, March, because there was this, I think similar to the US, for some reason, there was this notion that this kind of stuff happens over there. And it's not going to happen in India for whatever reason. And the funny thing is that obviously I think for China, it's been kind of like, as you say in football, a game of two halves, where the first part of it was botched completely in Wuhan. No doubt about that. I think through December and January. But the fact that I think since March that they've been able to get it under control at home, nobody here believes that. No one where I'm sitting in India believes that, you know, local transmission in China is under control. And I think that when I mentioned to people that I'm supposed to go back to Beijing, people are like, are you crazy? Why would you go back there? I think the majority of people here believe that there's a huge outbreak going on in China at this very moment that's being suppressed. So I think that people have been very skeptical right from the get-go of how China has dealt with it, which I found quite interesting. And to me, it kind of hints at the larger mistrust that people have, which I think it's historical. I think it goes back to the 60s is what I argue in the book, that unless you come to terms with the history, this is going to repeat itself. Because I think there's the gut reflects, I think for many people in India, is if something's happening in China, it's probably not true, and don't believe it. But I think on the flip side of that is, I don't know. I think it's the same question people in the US are asking. If we were paying attention to what was happening there in January, would we have reacted better? I mean, even if China did suppress their handling of the outbreak in December and early January, I mean, when a country of 1.4 billion people locks down as they did in January 23rd, surely that's a sign that something big is happening, but people weren't paying attention to it. And to me, it's said a lot about how we look at China as well.
Same problem over here in the United States, I have to say. Anant, you've said before that you think this year, 2020, this annus horribilis for pretty much everyone around the globe will, but as far as the India-China relationship, you think it will go down as a major inflection point, that it marks the beginning of a much more confrontational relationship driven by nationalism and other forces. Can you talk about what's driving the decline?
No, I believe that, Jeremy, and I think that when you look back at the relationship I mean, some of the years that really come to mind are the war in 62, the normalization that began in 1988. And I mean, some of the people that I know who've been following this relationship in India for decades believe very strongly that 2020 is going to go down and the relationship is one such year. And I think some of this was happening even before the boundary crisis began in early May, which actually the Indian government played down for more than a month until they were forced to confront it, when you had this terrible incident that led to the first deaths since 1975. I think that, honestly, I don't know if we'll ever have a clear answer for why China took the step that it did in early May to deploy two divisions and try and unilaterally redraw the line of actual control. Frankly, I think we spent too much time trying to guess the motivations, which we may never know. I mean, people are still debating why Mao Zedong went to war in 62, and there's no agreement whether it was because of Tibet or whether it was to teach Nehru a lesson or something else. But I think that for whatever reason, I think that the leadership in China has come to the view that this relationship wasn't worth preserving, which is why that they were willing to take the step regardless of the fallout that it would have. And it's really called into question the I think for me, the founding sort of premise of this relationship, which is you have historical problems, you have legacy issues, but you compartmentalize them, you put them to the side, and you try to find places to work together, whether it's on trade or climate change or what have you. But I think the Indian government has come to the view now that that's no longer possible, which is why they've been taking all these steps in curtailing Chinese investment, banning Chinese apps. And I think that the boundary is going to be front and center again for the first time in many, many years. And for me, that's not a good thing at all. And that means that the relationship is going to be more confrontational. I think that the days of trying to compartmentalize are over. And so I think for people who are invested in this relationship, whether it was in education, wanted more two-way travel, or in business ties, I think it's going to be a very difficult period going forward with, I think, the current leadership in both countries.
So we have time for just one really quick answer, I think, Kaiser. Pallavi, so has the spirit of Sini Hindi bye-bye really gone bye-bye? Or do you think there's still any kind of foundation for mutual understanding?
So I think, you know, the Chini Hindi bye-bye went through three different iterations. So you had the Chini Hindi bye-bye of the 1940s, 50s, the post-colonial camaraderie of Pan-Asianism and so on. I do think that in the early 2000s, when I was in China, we went through another iteration, which was Chini Hindi Chini bye-bye, where economics was actually driving.
B-U-Y.
And we saw trade sort of, you know, growing exponentially every year. We had a doubling and tripling. And as Anand said, there was a consensus that the border issue should be kept on the back burner. And I think the official language was that it's a problem left over by history. And, you know, that's what it is. And now we're again seeing bye-bye, as you very clearly pointed out, with the border coming very strongly back in the center of the bilateral relationship. So, yeah, I mean, I think the bye-bye is tampered down, like the BUY is tampered down by the, is dampened by the growing trade deficit as well between India and China, which in the earlier part of this millennium was far more equal. And now we've seen this resurgence of sort of strategic competition and the military kind of coming back into the equation as well. So it's indeed worrying times.
And the idea of betrayal never really kind of going away. That's a grim prognosis, I'm afraid. I hate ending a show on anything quite that. So, come on, surely there's some...
Kaiser, you eternal American optimist, forget about it.
Right.
Things can always get worse, as I never cease telling
there's
you.
There's a lot of Indian yoga teachers. There's a lot of Indian yoga teachers in China at the moment. So I don't
there's
know
hope.
Go yoga teachers. So, I mean, if we can actually, a new foundation based on bilingual puns, yoga teachers, and I'm seeing a growing fondness among my Chinese friends for Indian food, so maybe that's
Indian restaurants,
yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And Chinese food has always been, not Chinese, yeah, Chinese not food China. From China, but Indianized Chinese food has always been hugely popular.
Manchurian chicken.
The original title for my first book, Smoke and Mirrors, was going to be Paneer Manchurian. But then my publisher thought it sounded too much like a food memoir. And so we called it Smoke and Mirrors, somewhat more boringly, I think. But yes, paneer, the Manchurian is this thing that was invented in Bombay and which signifies Chinese food for the average Indian. That when they think Chinese food, that's
it's
what
the chop
think.
Suey of
something
India,
Manchurian.
Basically.
There's a great story of when Hu Jintao went to India in 2006 and they scoured Delhi and Bombay to find, like, you know, the most authentic Chinese chef that they could find. So they flew him into Delhi, had him prepare this fantastic meal, authentic Chinese food, and they served it to Hu Jintao, at the end of which I think the Indian side asked, you know, what did you make of the meal? And then President Hu was like, you know, so it's the first time I've had Indian food, so I'm really, really happy. That was what he said.
okay, we can end there. That's a great one. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much to Catherine and to Joe and to all the other great people at the Hong Kong International Literary Festival for inviting us. Thank you so much, Anath. It was so great to see you. And Pallavi, wow, wonderful to catch up.
Yeah,
like this.
Even if just online. Great to see
Absolutely.
You both.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Jeremy, yeah. As always, yes. We'll see you we see each other all the time on social media, but I miss you guys and hope that we can all reunite one day in Beijing.
Thank you so much, Kaiser, Jeremy, Pallavi, and hope that happens soon.
Thanks, Anna. Thanks, Pallavi. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.
Take care, everyone. All righty.
Bye-bye.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.